Thanks so much for listening in today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. You know, there are many reasons for thinning hair besides genetics. We often think, you know, it's genetic, but that's not always the case, as we'll find as we talk with Dr. Apple Bodimer. Great to have her back with us. She's a dermatologist, associate professor in the Department of Dermatology at UW-Madison. She directs the Integrative Dermatology Clinic. So we'll talk a bit about hair loss with her, just in light of our last interview with Chris Schroeder about his book, Headscape. But we can also take a look at other things as well. I want to ask her about dry skin. I get a little dry skin from time to time this time of the year. You might have that same issue. I know she can address melanoma with us as well. So lots we can talk about with her, and I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Apple, I know, I'm not sure you had a chance to hear any of our the interview beforehand. We talked with Chris Schroeder about his getting his hair replanted from the side of his head to the top of his head. But I'm wondering, what are some of the more common causes of thinning hair? And maybe aside from genetics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that is a really big one. That's probably the one that we see the most commonly. But another one that we see really, really commonly is called telogen effluvium. And that's been especially an issue since COVID. Everybody's life has turned upside down. This type of hair loss, this telogen effluvium, we commonly see it as just a few shedding, where people are just losing huge amounts of hair in the shower. They're finding it on their pillow. They're finding it on their clothes. And that is caused by stress, and that can be either a physical stress, physiologic stress, like a heart attack, car accident. We see it often after a woman has a baby. It can also be emotional stress. And one of the things about this idea of emotional stress is, in our culture, we kind of have a negative association with stress. So we think, oh, you know, life is really great for me. I can't be having hair loss due to stress. But our bodies experience any kind of change as stressful. That sort of is the actual definition of stress, is any significant change in your life. So I have seen it happen even when people are, you know, having really great things happen, but they've gone through a lot of change. So and that's, you know, one that we can expect all that hair to regrow, or at least most of it, unless there's a concomitant other type of hair loss, which it's most common to see these two types of hair loss together, the genetic patterned thinning or balding and telogen effluvium.
So when do you know if you should see a professional about hair loss?
I think if you're having any symptoms associated with the hair loss, any itching, burning, stinging, that can be an indication that there's something else going on underneath the skin that might be in this autoimmune category of a scarring type of hair loss. And the scarring types of hair loss are really the ones that we want to identify early, because often there's inflammation going on at the level of the hair follicle that we can try to shut down to help save as many hair follicles as we can. A lot of times those types of hair loss go on and on before anybody kind of seeks out a physician. And it's really unfortunate that, you know, once I see a patient who's got fairly extensive scarring type of hair loss, there's not a whole lot we can do, including transplanting hair into that area. So those types of hair loss are much less common, but some of the symptoms, you know, can be significant itching, significant burning. So if you're noticing that, if you're like round patches, people will see, like, that's alopecia areata. That's also a fairly common type of autoimmune-related non-scarring hair loss. You know, those are something that a lot of times they will regrow on their own if it's limited. But if somebody's having a few bald spots that suddenly turn into a lot of bald spots, or they have whole swatches of their scalp that suddenly disappear, that, you know, really indicates that the autoimmune process has gone much further, and they should definitely seek out a professional's help with that. You know, I think it's never a bad idea to talk to somebody if you're having concerns. If your hair loss is affecting your quality of life, it's worth at least bringing up to your primary doctor so that they can look at your scalp and, you know, either reassure you that, that they feel confident that your scalp looks good, or to refer you onto a specialist who can, you know, either give you that reassurance or do some further investigating.
And, you know, thinking about the treatments for thinning hair, I think probably minoxidil is the, maybe the most common. It's used in products like Rogaine, right?
Yes. Yeah, that is the most common. It's available over the counter without a prescription. And that one helps, especially with the genetic type hair loss, thinning, balding that we see. The androgenetic alopecia is the term that's most commonly used for that. And, you know, that is something that does work well for many people. It's kind of messy, and it is time-consuming. And I often will tell people if they ask me, well, should I try this? And I let them know, you know, it depends on how much your hair loss bothers you. There are also other options, other medications that you can take orally, as well as some supplements that you can take orally. But those kinds of things would need to be a discussion with a physician to make sure that you're taking them safely. And that includes oral minoxidil. That's one that's gained a lot of popularity in the last year or so, but it's something that we have been doing in dermatology offices for a while now.
Yeah. And this microneedling, these treatments, they're relatively new, I think, to the U.S., but I mean, they've been going on in Turkey for a long time. But and Chris sort of described how they work, but in his case, they were taking 5,000 individual hair follicles from the side of his head, put them on the top.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so that's a little bit different than just microneedling. When we talk about microneedling, those are usually devices, either like a pen-like device or a roller that has very tiny needles that go a specific depth into the skin. And so what he was, it was a special technique of a type of hair surgery. So normally when we microneedle, we're not extracting hair follicles unless you have that special type of surgery that's done. And it is tricky with microneedling. I think especially sometimes people will do it to try to stimulate hair growth, or that's the thought. But you're also creating microtrauma to the scalp. And it just really depends. It's something, again, people can go on Amazon and buy microneedling rollers. I think in you know, anybody that I've talked to who does microneedling in a clinical practice or an aesthetics practice, the rollers tend to cause more problems with this small, you know, little scars that you could potentially be creating in whichever part of the body that you choose to microneedle, because it's also used for facials.
Oh.
It's used to penetrate a topical product more deeply into the skin. And so there's a lot that goes in with microneedling that.
Got it.
That beyond just for hair loss.
And there's also this low-level laser therapy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the low-level light laser treatment. So those are the red lights, the caps, combs, or brushes, and there's a variety of FDA-approved products out there. They don't work for everybody. I think an easy way that I kind of explain it, and this is kind of bears out in my practice, is I think they work for about half of people. And it's tricky because the caps work better for people who have a lot of thinning on top. So and I see this particularly in women who start getting thin on top. They may look like they have a really thick head of hair, you know, and so that's one thing that is, as a physician, I need to be really careful of. I might look at somebody and think, oh, they're not having any hair loss. But when they come to me and tell me their ponytail is half the size it was and that it's having a significant effect on their quality of life, then I need to be much more careful and look more carefully at what's going on. And so somebody who might still have a lot of hair density, even though they're in the process of losing it, those caps, it's really hard to get the laser directly to the scalp. We need that light on the scalp. So for those people, a comb or the headbands might be a better option.
You know, we did just talk about this hair transplant procedure. I'm wondering, what are your thoughts on the technique?
Yeah. I mean, I think whenever you're having hair transplanted done, you want to make sure, and it sounds like Chris really did a good job and did his research, but make sure you're working with someone who does a lot of them. It's a very time-consuming and costly surgery, and, you know, there aren't a ton of people that do hair transplants. I think, you know, here in Madison, I know of one right now. There are probably a small handful, others that I may not be aware of. But it is something that has, because it's so time-consuming and so costly to perform, you know, it is a very expensive on the patient side as well. And I think one of the things that I have seen come out of the surgeries, and now the techniques are a lot better than they used to be. I think people have all seen someone who has those plugs where you've got these like doll hair plugs with multiple. And that's, those are the older types of techniques. Really now it's a lot more elegant and the outcomes are a lot better. But you do need to be aware that you're likely to hold on to the transplanted hair, even in areas where you may have previously lost. But if your genetics are such that you're likely to continue to progress and lose more hair, you can end up with some very unnatural looking hair patterns. You know, so if somebody's just really doing the frontal crown or the front part of the top of their head, because that's where they're losing it the most, as they continue to progress in their sort of in that the natural genetic patterned hair loss type progression, they're going to tend to lose more in the back, and they may end up with these weird kind of bald patches. So again, that's something that you really want to talk to the surgeon that you choose. You might want to look at pictures. You want to know how many surgeries they do, what their experience is. And then I would ask to look at pictures or even talk to the patients. You know, of course, they're going to give you the best of the best, but it does give you some experience. And you know what a really great looking hair transplant at 5 or even 10 years, 20 years down the road, you might not be happy with it, depending on where they transplant those hairs. If they're doing a nice job of distributing those transplanted hairs throughout areas where you might even still have some decent density, where it's kind of starting, but then you're going to end up with a more natural look long term.
Dr. Apple Bodimer, our guest today, we've started talking with her about hair and thinning hair. But we're dealing with other issues as well. Bob in Claybanks, I know, has a question relating to skin cancer, and I hope he can hang around to ask that question. You may have a question of your own, and I hope you'll join us at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. We'll take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back to answer Bob's question and yours as well. I'm Larry Mueller. Talking with our guest today, Dr. Apple Bodimer, dermatologist and associate professor in the Department of Dermatology at UW-Madison. Talked a bit about thinning hair with her. We're talking about skin cancer and skin cancer prevention and dry skin as well. That was on the top of my mind. Maybe not yours, but maybe you have a different kind of question. Have you tried UPF clothing, by the way? Did that work for you? What questions you have about skin cancer? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's turn to Bob in Claybanks. Bob, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having the show. I was really recently diagnosed with squamous skin cancer on the top of my head. And the initial dermatologist recommended either Mohs or a radiation type of therapy. And I wanted to get a second opinion, and I'm waiting to see another dermatologist. But they talk about four other different types of therapy, excision, cryotherapy, curettage, and electrocautery, and photodynamic. And I wondered what the guest's opinion was of those treatments.
Yeah, it really would depend on the type of squamous cell cancer that you have. If they're recommending Mohs or radiation, my guess is that it's a little bit more invasive. For superficial squamous cell cancers, there are a few more options, and that would include the ED&C, which is electrodesiccation and curettage. So those we usually do combined. Some people will use cryotherapy and curettage. And with both of those, the curettage basically means we're taking a sharp curved blade to kind of scrape around the edges of where the cancer is. The skin that's affected with the cancer has a very different texture. So in the hands of somebody who has experience doing these procedures, we can kind of feel where the cancer ends. And that really only pertains to the superficial type, because especially with squamous cell cancers, they can go deeper and be a little bit more invasive. It's not really common, but we would really want to make sure that we got the whole thing out, especially with it being on the top of your head. There's not a lot of skin laxity there. So if it you know, if we were to sort of do a scraping and burning procedure for an invasive squamous cell cancer, that cancer could continue to grow underneath the scar and become a much bigger deal in the end. The photodynamic therapy is something that we really don't use for skin cancer. I've never seen it used for skin cancer. I'm guessing there may be some people out there that do that, but I would not go in that direction. It can be really useful for treating precancerous lesions. So the precursors to squamous cell cancer we call those actinic keratoses, and photodynamic therapy is one option. The better option is a topical chemotherapy medication. And there are a couple of different ones that we use. You would have to talk to your doctor about which one would be ideal for you if you decided to go that route. And again, the topical chemotherapy really only works well for those superficial skin cancers. And I think you had another form of treatment in there. I thought there were four, the curettage. Oh, the cryotherapy. I think I kind of touched on that. We use cryotherapy alone for treating those precancerous or precursor lesions called actinic keratoses. But cryotherapy alone is not a great way to treat an actual skin cancer once it's sort of made that kind of made that move.
Bob, does that help?
That's helpful.
Yes, it does. Thanks very much.
Yeah, I appreciate the call. Let's take another call. Ann in Waukesha, it's your turn. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Dr. Apple. I have lumps on my head. When should I see a dermatologist? My husband says I'm growing horns because I'm the devil.
I don't think so. Yeah, I mean, without knowing for sure what they are, again, I can't see them. But if there have been lumps that you've had for a long time, is that
right, Ann?
Yeah, they've been around for a while, you know, since maybe 3 or 4 years.
Okay. So, you know, we see lumps on the head. Often they're cysts that kind of occur underneath the skin, but not always. So I would say if you're getting more of them, if you're continuing to get more of these, then I would definitely have that looked at. Because especially being on the scalp, you won't be able to see if there's any overlying skin changes. If they are these kind of generic this, then, you know, it may be good to have that peace of mind, like, yes, there's nothing else going on. But if they become tender or painful or start getting in the way of your hairstyling practices, like combing, brushing, if they're getting bumped on by hats or, you know, other headgear helmets that you might wear for whatever activities you like to do, you know, that would be a time for sure to get into to have them looked at. But again, if you're continuing to get more of them, if they're painful or tender, those are definitely clues.
There you go, Ann. Yeah, good luck. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Lena in Stevens Point, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Lena.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I was curious if you could speak to melanin and if it kind of acts as a protective factor to protect against certain kinds of skin cancer? And if so, if you can kind of speak to maybe a little bit of the science behind that.
That's a huge topic. I mean, I think we could have a whole several hours to talk just about melanin, because there are different types of melanin. And everybody is going to have a different combination of those types. We kind of break that down into something called eumelanin and pheomelanin. Eumelanin is packaged within the cell. So melanocytes make melanin. And then they have these arms, they're kind of like amoebas, that distribute the melanin to the surrounding keratinocytes. And those are the cells that make up the bulk of our skin. Eumelanin is packaged in much bigger globules and tends to kind of accumulate around the nucleus, giving it a little bit more of a protective factor in terms of the DNA damage. Pheomelanin is packaged in much smaller droplets, and that tends to be more distributed throughout the cytoplasm of the cell, or the material that kind of all of the parts of the cell float around in. You know, and so somebody who is very, very pale, like a traditional, like we would kind of often think of folks with the Irish type skin, light hair, light eyes, really light skin that tend to burn really, really easily, they're going to have predominantly pheomelanin, whereas somebody with very, very dark skin is going to have predominantly eumelanin. And then, you know, obviously there's a huge range of how much melanin we have. does it protect against skin cancer? To some degree, yes. But I wouldn't hang your hat on that and say, just because I'm somebody that has a lot more pigment in my skin, I'm just not going to wear sunscreen and not going to ever worry about getting skin cancer. Certainly, people of all different skin types get skin cancer. Fair-skinned people are at a higher risk, but we definitely see all types of skin cancer in other populations as well. The other side of that is that aging happens to all of us. We all are going to wrinkle, and you know, we're all going to get blotchy discoloration of the skin. And the vast majority of what we think of as aging is actually photoaging. Almost all, most of it is really induced by UV radiation exposure to the skin cells, damages to the DNA. So even when it's not accumulating, leading to actual skin cancer or precancerous lesions, it can it definitely creates that aging process. Anybody who has moles, we know that UV radiation on any type of skin or any skin type can trigger moles to kind of start becoming more atypical. So, you know, I think those are, and I'm not sure, I kind of want to check in with you and make sure I'm on the right track. Is this what you're hoping to learn about?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's definitely, I think, mixed information out there just on like media channels and media outlets about the idea of wearing sunscreen, you know, for folks of color and things like that. So I just think it's an important topic to talk about. And I was definitely really curious. So, yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah. And I would say to that point, you know, some of us need to be wearing sunscreen all the time, every time we're outside. You know, some of us don't need to be quite as obsessive about it. However, what I tell all of my patients is we're all going to age. Most of my patients care about that,
yeah.
You know, and sunscreen does a good job. And I actually say sunscreen, but I'm a much bigger fan of the protective measures that we can take in terms of wide brimmed hats, wide rimmed sunglasses, and the UPF protective clothing, because sunscreen is imperfect. If we put sunscreen on at 6 a.m. before we go to work, we head from our car to the office at 7 a.m. where it still might be dark, and then we go out at lunchtime for our walk at the high noon, that sunscreen is still not protecting us. So really focusing on looking at the whole UV protection and weighing that with what is your skin cancer risk. Does everybody in your family have skin cancer? Is there melanoma in your family history? What is your sun exposure when you were young? Did you have tons of blistering burns when you were young? Were you somebody, regardless of your skin type, did you spend a lot of time in tanning beds? You know, those kinds of things dramatically increase risk, and we should really look at it as kind of the whole picture, besides jumping on a bandwagon here and there and saying, you know, everybody needs to do this and nobody should do that.
Lena, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Apple, you started to talk about moles, or you mentioned moles. Let's get in on moles a little bit more, or sort of little growths that happen on your back or wherever.
Yes. So, you know, there are several different growths that we get as we get older, and moles are one of them. We tend to get moles when we're young, and by the time we're 40 or 50, we really shouldn't be getting too many new moles. Some people still do. You know, I'm somebody that seems to continue to grow very normal moles even later in life. So that just because you have a new mole kind of later in life doesn't mean it's necessarily bad, but it is one we would pay a lot closer attention to. These other types of growths that we get are really, really common, and it's really common for people to come in concerned, most usually something called a seborrheic keratosis. They can be warty. They can be pretty ugly. My grandma told me when I was in my 20s, she said, Apple, I've gotten so old, I'm growing mold. And I laugh and say, Grandma, it's not mold. people will call them liver spots when they're flat sometimes. You know, so they can be flat, they can be pink, they can be white, they can be brown, they can be black, they can get itchy. When you scratch them, they can bleed. So they can be very concerning. And, you know, people can get really worried about these, and rightfully so. If you don't have the experience of knowing what you're looking for and you're not looking at your skin regularly, they can be really, really worrisome. And the antidote to that, and this is something I talk about with all my patients at some point or another, is the importance of skin self-exams. So it's really important that all of us, regardless of our risk, regardless of our family history, regardless of our skin type, are just taking 3 to 5 minutes once a month to look at your skin, at least every other month. So if you're somebody that has really almost no risk, then I might give you a little bit of a break. But we really want to be doing that on a regular basis. It's good to schedule it so that your brain is in a very relaxed state, so that you get a gut sense of like, oh, this is what my skin looks like. And I tell my patients, that's what I want. I don't want you to get up close and personal with every single mole. I don't want you to come in saying like, this mole is you know, 2.5 millimeters bigger than it was 6 weeks ago. That's not necessary. So some people go into this thinking like, oh, I've got so many moles, I've got so many growths. It's like looking for a needle in a haystack. I just can't do it. And they start stressing out. And that kind of shuts down that subconscious part of the brain that we really want activated when you're doing this. The more you do it, the earlier you start, the better you're going to get at it. And that's the most powerful tool you have at detecting skin cancer early. Because even if you're somebody that ends up seeing a dermatologist on a regular basis for whatever reason, you know, I have had patients that develop melanoma within 2 months. I've seen them, nothing was there. 2 months later, they come back and they've got a melanoma. So those skin checks are really, really important. And that can help you get used to the kinds of spots you're going to start growing as you get older. And, you know, if you have concerns, checking in, a lot of primary doctors are really comfortable with this. A lot of, you know, other types of providers like nurse practitioners and physician assistants, because they see so many of them. And if they see it and they're not sure, then that's usually when you end up in a dermatologist's office, or if you're somebody who's already hooked in with a dermatologist for another reason, it's a good time to ask, like, you know, and I see this every day. I have patients that come in, their wife or their husband saw a dark brown spot on their back and it's itchy, you know, and a lot of times it ends up being these seborrheic keratoses. So it's a good time that I'll educate them and say, this is what these look like. They can be warty. I want you to get started with your skin self-check so you start to know the kinds of spots your body makes so that you can feel comfortable. Like, oh, that's just another one of these kind of growths that's kind of related to my age and my genetics versus something that I should be worried about.
Hmm. Roger in Grantsburg has something for us. Roger, hi.
Hi, Larry. Nice, great show. Perfect topic. Well, dude, I haven't heard anything if she touched on the different occupations as a hazard, like farming. You see all these guys out there with sleeveless shirts and, you know, men out in the sun all the time. Pretty soon it's like, I went to one doctor and he says, hey, nice skin cancer. And I looked at him like, oh, I kind of made me think, you know, and I had a mole on my arm that kept getting bigger and changing. It changed color, basically. And I got kind of worried about it after he said this comment, and I went in and they took tech, checked it out and sent it in, and I burned it off, took it off, sent it in. It wasn't cancer or anything, but it made me really think that, you know, hey, this maybe you shouldn't be out here sleeveless shirts and constantly day after day after day, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that really is true, you know, especially if the sunscreens and we didn't have UPF protective clothing, you know, back in my day when I was growing up, for sure, you know, and it's a tough one because you're right. Farmers, they're outside most of the summer. And you know, road workers, carpenters, people that are outside building houses, you know, these people do a huge service for us and they are exposed, more. And, you know, the other thing that is maybe less common but important to recognize is welders, because they get exposed to really high amounts of the whole UV spectrum when they're doing their work. And you know, those are people that may be at a higher risk for skin cancer as well. So, you know, if you're somebody that spent your life in one of those types of occupations, it is important. You know, and I would say get your skin looked at least get a baseline. Not everybody needs to see a dermatologist every year. You know, but if you've at least got a baseline and can get some reassurance about what's going on, then you've at least made that connection and can get some questions answered so that you can be more effective in keeping a closer eye on your own skin.
Roger, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Ann in Madison emailed, her hair didn't come back from a stem cell transplant for leukemia 15 years ago. It's been hard to be a woman and bald since she was 47. Years old. A dermatologist told her she doesn't have the form of alopecia that can be treated. The hair follicles were destroyed by graft versus host disease, or GVHD. Yeah. It's a complication that affects skin And in roughly half the patients who undergo a transplant using stem cells from a donor. And she says this topic on hair loss gives her an opportunity to raise awareness of this difficult and sometimes life-threatening complication.
Yeah, and GVHD, can affect any part of the skin. And the tricky thing with that is it leads to scarring. And so as I alluded to earlier, if you have scarring on the scalp, there's really not a lot of blood flow there. Or, you know, radiation is another place where we see that, where you can't really transplant hair into these areas because it's not going to be able to take very well, because we just don't have the ability to get nutrients to help feed those hair follicles. So, yeah, I'm really sorry that you had that experience, and it is an unfortunate side effect.
Laura emailed to ask for advice on skincare products and routine for healthy aging and maintenance. Are there affordable products that you can recommend on or books on healthy skin routine for those who are 60 and older?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, and I'm a minimalist, so I will disclose that. I think, you know, we can get really involved in very complex skincare regimens. And for some people, that feels good. They like that idea of spending that time kind of taking care of themselves, especially as people may be shifting their lifestyles and maybe have a little bit more time. I think there's three basic categories that you want to think about. One is UV protection and a good quality mineral-based sunscreen. If you have sensitive skin, you may want to look for one that's formulated for babies. The chemical-based sunscreens have come under a lot of scrutiny and under some fire in more recent years, because of the concerns about absorption and the concerns about what they might be doing kind of at the endocrine level, as well as disrupting other systems in our body. So, you know, for a long time, I've been recommending the mineral base, and I say just stick to that. You'll find that on the ingredient list. It'll say active ingredients, and you'll want to make sure that you're looking for either titanium dioxide, zinc oxide, or iron oxide is a newer one to the scene. The second that you'll want to use is a really gentle cream-based cleanser. A lot of the harsh soaps can really dry the skin out and can actually make you more prone to blemishes. And it's kind of in that 60 and older age group, rosacea tends to be more of a problem. And so we really want to clean the skin gently and not disrupt the skin barrier too much. And then we want to moisturize. So those are kind of the three categories that I think are really essential to kind of maintaining healthy skin really at any age. Then there's a whole other category of anti-aging products, and those you need to use carefully. They're not magic. There's no cream that's going to take care of the deep, we call them the 11s, the deep wrinkles that we have on the glabella or central forehead, or those deep crow's feet and the sides of the eyes. There's no cream that's going to fix that. You know, you're really looking at something much more aggressive in terms of cosmetic procedures or injectables. But if you're wanting to just kind of keep your skin healthy and kind of glowing, there are a number of products that can be helpful. You just, again, need to be careful if you're somebody with sensitive skin. A lot of these things like the alpha hydroxy acids or the retinols can really irritate the skin. It's tricky because without knowing somebody's specific concerns and the extent of it, it's hard to recommend, you know, without specifically seeing the amount of wrinkling that somebody has or the amount of dispigmentation. And that, when I say that, I mean the blotchiness that we get. Because sometimes the topicals aren't going to really even do enough with the topical over-the-counters. Sometimes you really need to look at some prescription-type medications.
Well, Dr. Appel-Bodimer, it is always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today. I hope you'll be back, come back and be with us again. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Of course. Thank you for having me. It was my pleasure.
Dr. Appel-Bodimer, dermatologist, associate professor in the Department of Dermatology at UW-Madison. Always a pleasure. This is a great show today, in my opinion. I hope it was in yours as well. Tomorrow, we'll look at phosphorus sustainability, how to use less and how to keep it from our soil and water. And then the Great Lakes fish populations, how are they doing? We'll look at that as well. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.